Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. I have with me Brad Wilcox. Brad, how you doing?
Good. It's good to talk to you, JJ.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you, Brad. You know, I've got to tell you, you're like one of my favorite authors of all time.
When oh, thanks.
You're welcome. I mean, it's like when my father passed away 2.5 years ago, the first book I picked up was your Continuous Atonement. Because I wondered, you know, like what was the purpose of those of us that are, you know, left here on earth, you know, like what was the purpose of living and what were we supposed to be doing, you know, like, you know, from those who have gone on. And reading in your book and, you know, in Continuous Atonement, it just made so much sense to me on why it is, you know, that some of us are here after loved ones have passed on. And it really helped me, you know, through, you know, like a lot of the grieving process and learning more about the atonement. And so I just thought that that was a fabulous book.
Thank you. I'm glad it was meaningful to you at a time that was such a turning point. You know, the loss of a loved one is one of those times where it really forces all of us to face difficult questions and difficult challenges. And as we overcome those, as we gain perspective, it does strengthen us and make us better.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's like, it's, you know, I mean, it's still, the healing process still takes time. But I mean, it's a, it was definitely like one of my favorite books of all time. And then all of a sudden it's like, you come out with Continuous Conversion, and I'm like, oh.
I'm so glad you found it, and I'm so glad you've liked it.
Well, thank you. But I guess my thing is what inspired you to come up with Continuous Conversion? I mean, and how long was the process for you to get this book written?
You know, both books have their roots in my own life experiences, and so both of them have been a long time in coming. You know, I think back, I started writing the Continuous Atonement unofficially, I mean not really writing it, but starting to grapple with some of the questions and thoughts as I was a bishop of a young single adult ward. So these were college age students. And I would see them come and talk to me about some of their problems, and then they'd feel better, and then they'd mess up again, and then they'd come talk to me, and then they'd feel better, and then they'd mess up again. And about the third time through that cycle, they'd finally just give up. They'd just want to quit. And I thought, there has to be a way of teaching the atonement so that people don't feel like the only option is to be perfect or to quit. They've got to realize that the atonement is there as we transform, as we are changed, as we are made better. It's not just something that helps us be forgiven, and it's not just something that helps us after we die, and it's not something that just helps us during trials and difficult times like the passing of your loved one. The atonement actually is a means of transforming us. The power of the atonement is available to us as we make positive changes in our lives. And with that in mind, then I started, you know, writing the book, but I also realized that conversion, in a similar way, I think too many people think of conversion as a one-time event. You're converted. Well, think about learning a foreign language. Is there a day when you don't speak Spanish and then all of a sudden you do? Is there a day when you don't speak English and all of a sudden you do? No, it's the continual process of learning. I'm fluent in Spanish, I'm fluent in English, and yet if I don't continually use those languages, it starts backing up on me, and I start losing some of the vocabulary in both languages. And so I think that if we start looking at conversion, positive changes, as a process, And as we realize that the source of power to be able to make those changes lies in Jesus Christ and his atonement, then all of a sudden there's a perspective that allows us to move forward and not feel like quitting, not feel like tossing in the towel, not feel like giving up.
So do you feel like that most of the time, like when you're a bishop, and you're trying to, you know, get these kids to continue to move forward, even though they've moved back a few steps, do you feel that most of the time the reason why they felt like that they failed is because they didn't have confidence in themselves, maybe looked at themselves like lower than other people or peers or anything like that?
I think comparison is an issue, you know, looking sideways and saying, gosh, he's further along, he's much further along than I am, or she's so much better than I am, I could never measure up. And I think that that kind of comparison is a problem. But I also think sometimes we set pretty high expectations for ourselves. And I'm not against high expectations. I think it's important that we set them. The Savior himself said, "Be ye therefore perfect." I mean, is there a higher expectation? But I think it's vital for us, as we set high expectations for ourselves, it's vital that we step back and realize that we're not going to reach those lofty goals in one day or 2 days or even one lifetime. That this is a process that takes time, and that Christ is willing to help us. Not once we get our acts together, once we break all our bad habits, once we get everything in our lives put in order, he's willing to help us all the way along. Coming to Christ is not the end. It's a means to the end. The end, that lofty goal, is becoming like Christ. But as we work toward that goal, Christ isn't waiting for us to get worthy. He is willing to help make us worthy. And he is willing to help us as long as that process takes. So I guess the thing is that whether our expectations are coming from outside of ourselves or whether they're coming from inside of ourselves, we've got to just realize that it takes time, and that we are not alone in this climb.
So now I know that because, you know, most of the time, a lot of people, when they do have their struggles, feel alone and feel like that, you know, even climbing like a little anthill is impossible for them. And I've noticed that, reading through the New Testament and really getting in and studying the personality of Christ is that Christ is definitely very patient and very loving. He went directly to those that were looked at as lower than, you know, like anyone else in the stature, and he went straight to them and he started teaching them because he felt that they would be more receptive.
Yes. In the scriptures, oh, I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
In the scriptures, we continually read that his arms are outstretched still. And I think sometimes because we disappoint ourselves, then we think that we have disappointed him. And I think we've got to remember that Christ and God have a much larger perspective of our lives than we do. We are looking at our lives from one perspective, but they are looking at them from a different perspective. And I think the best comparison to make is what we think when we look at a child. When a child is learning to walk, we know that process is going to take time. We don't expect the child to get it right the first time. We praise every effort along the way, and we value those efforts. We encourage them. And if a kid falls, we don't say, "Oh man, he really disappointed me." we say, come on, you can do it, try one more time. And pretty soon, walking is second nature to the child. And I think sometimes when we stumble and fall, we think God's up there mad at us, or God's up there furious at us. And we have to remember that from God's perspective, we're little children. And He knows that falling is part of the learning. And so He patiently stands with His arms outstretched, just like a loving parent across the room, and says, my hands are outstretched still. Come unto me. Come unto me. And I just think that that is a beautiful perspective to keep, because if we see Him as wanting to help us learn to walk, instead of sitting back and criticizing us because we've fallen, then I think we're seeing Christ and God in their true characters.
And so, because one thing that I've noticed is that there never seemed to be a time where, like, Christ would ever raise His voice. There was never, it's like, well, except for one. But other than that, He never raised His voice. He was always very patient with everybody. And He has always been, like, the type of person who actually, I think He was maybe, like, the first person to see everybody as, like, equal to each other, instead of one being higher than another.
Yeah, and think, even at times when Christ disciplined, I mean, you know, we think of Him as He cast money changers out of the temple, and definitely we saw that He was making wrong things right. He had very forceful words for the hypocrites and the Pharisees. But we have to remember that when He cleansed the temple, He sat down and took the time to weave a whip. This wasn't a fit of rage. This wasn't an uncontrolled anger. This was a premeditated, thoughtful teaching moment. And I think in the same way, we've got to realize that Christ is teaching us. But as He teaches us, He's teaching us in a loving way. And that's what we've got to remember, is that even when He speaks clearly, even when His expectations and commandments are expressed in very clear and uncertain terms, and even when we may feel a little reproached or disciplined by God, we've got to remember that all of that comes with love, and that none of that is in a fit of rage. All of that is in a loving effort to help lift us to the next level.
Okay. And then, so then with the, so with your book, who's, are you, your continuous conversion, is your book basically for, like, a specific set of people that you're looking at, or were you looking to write it for, say, like, everybody, because this is something that you've learned along the way?
Well, I think about my audience, I think I'm writing specifically to people who are feeling discouraged, people who are feeling like giving up, people who are feeling like simply just tossing in the towel, whether it's in their families, in their marriages, in their church activity, in their feelings of faith and testimony. I mean, there's just too many who are out there just saying, I can't do this. And then they just give up. And I think we get it in our minds that it has to be all or nothing. And we've got to remember that just like a little kid learning to walk, we don't want all or nothing. We want baby steps. We want one little step at a time. And we want him to get up after he falls. And I think I was writing to people who are struggling. But I found that the response has been positive also from parents of those who are struggling, loved ones of those who are struggling, spouses of those who are struggling, leaders of those who are struggling. And so I think it's been amazing to me to see the reach of the book, because while I wrote it with one specific audience in mind, I guess it really has reached a broader audience, because everyone is struggling to one degree or another, and everyone loves someone who is at that crisis point saying, I'm giving up.
So do you find that it's hard for people to want help when they're struggling? You know, like for asking people, do you see it as like that a lot of people are trying to do things on their own?
Yeah. Boy, isn't that a true experience that we see all around us? You know, it's like when we need the doctor the most, we're not willing to go to the hospital. And when we need the medicine the most, we're not willing to take it. And when we need love and support, we're not willing to reach out for it. And I think that's one of the craziest things. We'll go to the doctor when we're not sick, but when we're sick, oh no, I'm not going to the doctor. He might think I'm sick. I mean, come on, what are we thinking? My friend told me one time when he was training for to go on a safari, he had to do some quicksand training, you know, like what to do in case somebody falls in quicksand or what to do if he fell in quicksand. And I found the training that he told me about to be fascinating, because he said that if you are stuck in quicksand, if you get yourself in quicksand, if you don't reach out, then you don't last very long. But he said, if you stretch out your arms and legs and you reach out, then there is a point at which it slows your sinking, and then people can get to you. People can help you. They can extend poles or vines or rods, and they can help pull you out. But he said, if people don't reach out, then they sink very quickly and there's not time to help the person. I think what a lesson in our lives. When we start to sink and we want to hide that from everybody around us, instead we should be reaching out with both arms and both legs. We should be reaching out for all we're worth, because that's how we will be able to survive. If we try to keep it all a secret, not tell anybody, and just pretend the quicksand is not there, then it's all going to be over really soon, and we're going to be stuck with some serious regrets.
So if someone's looking for someone that they don't really know, like, who to go to, would you say, like, a bishop or Relief Society or Elders Quorum or High Priest, presidents are like the best ones to reach out to for help, who would you suggest?
It's interesting that you would bring up church leaders first, because, you know, most people say go to professionals, but I think that a lot of people are leery of professional help until someone they know and love and trust says, here's somebody that you could go to that will help, or let's seek out some professional help. But most people don't turn to professionals right off. They turn to family, they turn to friends, and they turn to church leaders. Often church leaders play a very important role. Sister Chieko Okazaki, who once served in the General Relief Society presidency for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, she said that people need a third party, someone outside of the circle of family and friends, somebody who shares beliefs, who shares values, who shares a love of the family, but somebody who's not specifically in the family. I read another article that said that what teenagers need most of all is somebody who supports family values but is not a member of the family. Well, that sounds a lot to me like a bishop. That sounds a lot like a young men president, or a young men's president, or a young women president. Because that's somebody who supports values, who understands where the family's coming from. But sometimes it's hard for kids to talk to mom and dad. Maybe the kid feels like he's disappointing his parents. I mean, I look back at my own growing up, and I talked to some people who helped me a great deal, and I didn't have the courage to talk to my dad about some of the things I was struggling with because I loved him so dearly and I didn't want to disappoint him. Now as an adult, I realize that my dad would have been one, he would have been so willing to help, but I was the one who was immature. But I was so grateful that there was a bishop there. I'm so grateful there were youth leaders and family friends who were there so that I could talk to someone who supported and loved my family, supported what we believed, but also was far enough away that I felt safe.
Okay. So then you're a especially for you speaker, right?
Yes, I love that program.
So how do the kids, do a lot of the kids end up talking with you then after one of the programs?
Yeah, they often do, and they talk to their college-age counselors. Counselors not in professional counselors, but camp counselors, you know, leaders over small groups. And they do share. But in that setting, our number one job is to listen, to validate, to encourage that young person to go to a bishop, to go to somebody closer to home. Sometimes I think that a speaker at EFY is a little too far away to do any good. A kid can vent, a kid can unload, but I'm not there to actually follow up and make sure that something gets done and that a problem gets addressed. So I think it may be easy and safe for a kid to reach out to somebody who's far away. We see this often in emails. Kids will send emails to somebody who's very far away, like a general church leader or such. And in reality, that person may be so far away that other than just support and encouragement, there's not much you can offer except to say, go talk to mom and dad, go talk to your bishop, and encourage that kid to seek help from somebody who really can follow up the next week or the week after. And I think that most of the counselors and speakers at EFY try to take that approach. We don't flatter ourselves into thinking that we could solve a problem. Instead, we try to push and encourage that kid to reach out to somebody a little closer to home who really can help solve the problem.
Yeah, well, that's good to know, because I know that it's like when you know, those big events are put on, there's so many speakers and you know the spirit is so strong at those events that and you guys are basically like looked up to because of the strong spirit that you have from your life experiences that you know, I mean it's like a lot of people draw from that from you guys, and then when they go home it's like for some of them they don't have it there. So I'm glad to hear that you guys like try to encourage these young adults to find someone there, a bishop or someone that they can talk to, so then that way they can still strive to keep the spirit with them, so that way they don't lose it from going away from such a big event like that.
That's true. You know, my friend Randall Wright, who has spoken at EFY for many years, he's an author of many books on family and helping families be stronger. He's a wonderful man, and he talks about two levels of heroes. He says kids need heroes at multiple levels. They need heroes in their world. They need to be able to look at a sports star or a movie star or a big hero in the church. They need to look at an Elaine Dalton and say, wow, she's my hero. They need that. But he says they also need touchable heroes. Heroes they can look at who are so close to home, someone at the high school, someone in the ward, somebody in the neighborhood, somebody you can look at and say, gosh, if he can do it, I can do it. If she can do it, I can do it. And I think that that's very wise counsel, to help for all of us, but especially for young people, to seek heroes on multiple levels, be able to find, you know, untouchable heroes, but also to be able to find touchable heroes. And then as we think about Jesus and God, to be able to take them out of the realm of untouchable heroes and bring them into the realm of touchable heroes. I think that has to be one of the greatest things that a young person can do. I'm often asked to speak at programs for, in rehab programs, young people who've been sent and who are living in lockdown situations because they're breaking bad habits, because they're trying to get their lives put together. They're receiving a lot of professional help. And I once asked a man who owned one of these schools, these lockdown facilities, I asked him, I said, "What's your success rate?" And he said, "Oh, it's very high." I said, "But what about when they leave? What about when they get back out? They're back in the same situation with their same family, with their same friends." And then he kind of, it was interesting, his response, because he kind of looked around to make sure nobody was listening. And then he said very quietly to me, "The ones who connect with God make it." He says, "The ones who never make that connection with God struggle." And I thought that was so honest, but also so on target. Those who make a connection with God, those who take him out of the realm of the untouchable and bring him into the realm of the touchable, they find the power, the help, the grace to be able to make it through at the school, at the hospital, or at home. But those who never quite make that connection struggle. I've seen that to be true, not just in the young people in his program, but in the lives of many young people with whom I've had exchanges.
Yeah, so, I mean, because it, I know a lot of people have an idea that Christ is someone to be feared, and to, you know, and someone who's like domineering, someone who, you know, I mean, is, if you're not doing everything right, then he won't accept you. And as you were saying, you know, and for some reason, this image of him has gotten out like that. I mean, where people think he's just this all, you know, like all knowing, all powerful, you know, like domineering person. And then, as you were saying before, you know, he's not that way. He is loving. He is kind. He is patient. He is accepting. He is, you know, like all this. He, you know, and so how do people get in and actually find out for themselves that God is really loving and patient and full of love and not this domineering person that somehow has gotten out there?
Well, I think you're right. There is a very strange image of God in the minds of a lot of people. And probably that has to do with the fact that in their lives, maybe moms and dads haven't been an ideal figure. Maybe teachers haven't been an ideal figure. And so instead of trying to help with love, they see these figures of authority as being very frightening. And I think it's sad as they transfer those feelings that they have about a mom or a dad or a teacher, and they transfer those feelings of fear to God, because then they really do cut themselves away from the very help they need most. I think it helps if we will think about an analogy that Stephen Covey used to use. He would talk about circus mirrors, and he would say that if we look into the eyes of those around us, it's like looking in circus mirrors. Now, JJ, you've been to one of those carnivals where you walk up and you walk in, the mirrors all bent, And so you walk in front of the mirror and your head disappears, and you go in front of the next one and your hips look really big, and you go in front of the next one and you look really short. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, and those images are distorted. And that's why we laugh. We laugh at such distortions because we realize they're exaggerations, and we realize that our head doesn't really look like that. We realize that our hips don't look like that. We don't go out and buy new clothes because of the image we see in a circus mirror. We just kind of laugh. Well, Brother Covey said we need to do the same thing in our lives as we hear what people say about us, as we hear comments made, positive or negative. You're so awesome, you're so awesome, you're so awesome. Well, believe it or not, that's an exaggeration. You're terrible, you're horrible, you're no good. That's an exaggeration. And I think, as Brother Covey said, we need to lift our gaze away from these circus mirrors, and we need to look up. Because as we look away from people, including a mom or a dad or a teacher who may have given us a bad taste in our mouths, if we look up to God and approach Him in prayer, then He can be a real mirror. As we look into His eyes, we see a true reflection of who we are. Now, that doesn't mean that God's up there screaming, "You're awesome, you're awesome, you're awesome," like an anti-drug speaker. He's going to show us weaknesses as clearly as He shows us strength. But He then provides His grace, His divine help, His enabling power to be able to change weaknesses into strengths. As we turn to Him and depend on Him, then we are able to see these weaknesses be transformed into strengths. And we know that it is by His power. So I think the first thing that people need to do is to look up, look away from the world, look away from the images of the world and the comparisons of the world and the comments and judgments of the world. Look up. Privately, look up to God and see yourself in His eyes. Then, as we get that true reflection, turn to Him and ask His help. Ask and it shall be opened unto you. Knock and He shall open. Seek and ye shall find. These are phrases that are repeated over and over in the Scriptures. And as we truly reach out to Him and ask for that help, then He will help change weaknesses into strengths. I think it's very interesting that, you know, one man I know who's been dealing with a pornography problem for years, literally years, he says, "I always used to go to God and ask forgiveness because I knew I had offended Him." He says, now, with this new image in his mind, he is able to go to God and ask for His strength. Not just for His forgiveness, but for His strength. And he says that that little shift has made a huge difference in his life and in the progress he's been able to make in breaking this many-year addiction.
Nice. So, and that's something that, I mean, I've never heard anyone say that to also help, you know, with giving His strength as well. And that's great. I mean, when, after my father, you know, passed away, I was mad. And of course I was mad at, you know, at Heavenly Father, at God, you know, it's like, you know, and why He had to be taken. And then it's like, you know, and I told myself, I said, like, you know, Heavenly Father loves me so much that He's okay with me being upset with Him right now, because there was someone I loved very much who I won't be able to see for a while. You know, but I know that I know my Father's still around because I can still feel Him. But it was But I knew it was okay because I knew the Lord was more going to support me and he wasn't going to leave me. And it was totally okay for me to be mad with him because I understand he needed my father. But, you know, I mean, but I also knew that it was okay for me to vent and for me to, you know, to be able to talk to him as you would anybody else. And that all he would do, it was just, you know, hug me and tell me how much he loves me, you know.
Yes.
And until I understood, you know, why it was, you know, why my father had to do other work.
I think so. It's so sad that people have come to believe that the only way to reach God is through set prayers, prayers that are recited. The words come over and over. I was watching a MASH rerun the other night, and Father Mulcahy, who was the chaplain there in the MASH unit on the old TV show, he was at a point where he was trying to save somebody's life, and he said, oh, first I got to say a prayer. And then he said, oh, I can't think of one, I can't think of one. And then the comedy of it was that everybody was saying, just save his life, quit trying to say your prayer. And that was the comic joke. But in a way, I was very saddened by the scene because I thought, you know, here he was trying to remember a set prayer to say when all he needed to do was share with God his real feelings, his real desires. And sometimes, like you say, it's okay to be angry with God. When I took my kids to get shots, when we moved to Chile and my kids had to get shots, in fact, that's a funny story. They had to get shots, and we went and picked them up at school, and we said, hey, let's go get milkshakes. And then we ended up going to the hospital first before we got the milkshake. And my little daughter looked at me, and she said, I knew it was too good to be true. But, you know, when I take my kids to get shots, they're mad at me. Those little kids were mad at me, and when I held my daughter in my arms and held her arms down, so that she could get her shot, she was mad at me. But that's all right. I knew it was okay for her to be mad at me. I knew because I had a bigger perspective. She didn't want the shot, but I knew that in the long run, that was for the best and that she would weather it. She would survive it. And until she grew in maturity and could see things from my perspective, it was okay for her to be mad at me. It was okay for her to fight against my arms as I hugged her and held her tight so that she could get her shot. It was okay. I understood that. And as she's grown, then she can look back at that experience from a different perspective as well.
Nice. Well, talking about different perspective and totally shifting here, you said that you were trying to make salad your friend. So what's going on with that?
Oh my gosh, I can't believe. Yeah, in my introduction it says that my favorite foods are pepperoni pizza and peanut M&Ms, but that's not too healthy. So I'm trying really hard to learn to love salads. And I truly am. I think I haven't dealt with some of the addictions that a lot of people deal with. But I do understand where people are coming from as I zero in on some of the weaknesses that I have. And one weakness I have, some of it's genetic, some of it is just the environment I grew up in, and some of it is my own lack of self-control, but I do have a tendency to overeat. When I got on the scale, when I turned 50, 3 years ago, I got on the scale, and I had avoided that for many, many months and even years. And in my mind, I thought, oh, you know, maybe I'm around 200 pounds. Yeah, talk about deceiving ourselves. I got on that scale and I was at 250. I was over 250 pounds. And I just about died because I just couldn't believe that I had let things go to a point where I felt so out of control and unhealthy. About that time, I did what I'm telling you to do, what I'm telling listeners to do. I reached out. this was a problem I'd always tried to handle on my own. It was a problem I had forever fought on my own. And being alone in the battle, it was too easy for me to be good for 2 days and then say, oh, I've blown it now. You know, I ate one extra piece of bread. I've blown it now. I might as well just forget it. And then I'd go off and blow it even worse. And this cycle would happen over and over in my life. And so at that point, I reached out to a little former sixth grader of mine, a girl that I taught in sixth grade, for Pete's sake. But she's grown up now, and she actually is a personal trainer. And I reached out to her, and I said, I need help. And she said, okay, we'll help you. And I said, you got to make me two promises. One, don't make me run. I'll do anything but run. And two, don't let me quit. If I say I'm giving up, you just beat me over the head with the 2x4. Do whatever you have to do, but don't let me quit. So she made me those promises. She broke the first one. She kept the second one. She didn't make me run at first, but slowly but surely she'd get me on a treadmill and she'd say, let's just do 30 seconds. You can do 30 seconds. And then the next time she'd say, gosh, if you can do 30 seconds, you can do a minute. And that little girl just wormed her way into finally getting me last summer to run a half marathon. Nice. Me, Brad Wilcox, running a half marathon. And I did it. I now have lost 50 pounds, and it's still a struggle. It's not something that happened in 2 months. It's something that's taken 3 years. And I've lost the same pounds over and over and over again. I told my wife the other day, I think I've lost hundreds of pounds. The only problem is I keep losing the same ones. I'll gain and then I lose. And then I gain and then I lose. And then I gain and then I lose. But I'm not giving up. I go out, I work with Cody. She helps me. And I'm not giving up. And slowly but surely, I'm getting where I need to be. And I'm starting to change lifelong bad habits. And I'm starting to see a weakness being turned into a strength. So, JJ, just between you and me and our listeners, it's been a while since I've eaten my peanut M&Ms. It's been a while since I've eaten pepperoni pizza. I haven't cut them out of my life completely. But it has been a while since I've eaten those things, and I am trying hard to learn to like salads, and I sure like them a lot better now than I used to.
That's awesome. Love it. So now, what the thing is though, is that what I'm seeing from your struggle and then from like the books that you have written is that this all seems to kind of like tie in together, is that, you know, I mean, through time and experience, things can happen for us and for anybody.
Yeah. But, you know, you look around you. There are people who have time and nothing changes. And there are people around you who have experiences. I mean, you know, the loss of a father or getting on the scale and weighing 250 pounds. I mean, and yet nothing changes. I think the reason that change eludes so many people is because we continually try to separate it from a spiritual quest. We see change as something we do on our own, and spirituality as something in a completely different realm. And it's only as I've been able to combine those and realize that even my eating and my exercise has to be a spiritual journey. And as I have made it such, I have been able to find success that has eluded me every time in the past. Every time in the past, all my friends are saying, oh, how'd you lose weight, Brad? What pill are you taking? What diet are you on? What oil are you wiping on your earlobes? What program are you with? And I say, I'm eating right and I'm exercising. And they all look at me like, one, I'm crazy, and two, like, there's no way that could be the answer. And then those who are serious and ask even beyond that, I say, this is a journey I'm taking with God. This is something that God is helping me do. This isn't something I'm doing alone. I have Cody who helps me. She's my little trainer. But I also have God. And I am making this a matter of prayer. And I'm making this a matter of spiritual health. It's part of my spiritual health as well as my physical health. As I set my goals, as I ask for God's help in reaching those goals, as I receive His help, as I express gratitude for that, then suddenly this doesn't just become a physical change, it becomes a spiritual change. And I think that as I've been able to make that connection, then positive things have been happening.
Nice. That's awesome. So pretty soon you're going to be running 2 marathons?
You know what? It's funny that you say that, because just the other day my friend challenged me, said, next summer, a marathon. And I was like, no! but you know what? I think I'm going to do it. Now, more important than that, my daughter said, Dad, I'll run with you. And my wife said, okay, my knees are bad, but I can at least walk and I can run. And you know, it does help when we're working on something together instead of me trying to work all by myself. So who knows, JJ, maybe we'll have to do another show next summer and you can ask me if I did my marathon.
Hey, sounds good. So yes, we definitely like to have you on again, because this has been this has been a great interview. Thank you so much for being on with me, Brad.
Oh, thank you, JJ. I'm just so honored that the books have played a part in your life, and I'm so honored that you would take this time to let me share my feelings, my life experiences, and even my testimony of Jesus Christ with you, with your listeners.
Thank you so much, Brad. Thank you for that. And then it's over at the bookstores, or you can get it online, Continuous Atonement and Continuous Conversion with Brad
Continuous
Wilcox.
Continuous Diversion. That's probably a good title for my next one. That's one we could all relate to.
Exactly. All right. Well, thanks, Brad. And I guess we'll close. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening today.